I'm going to talk about the use of the STM for positional synthesis. And then backing up a little bit, this is 1999, backing up a little bit, the 1991 carbon nanotubes were discovered, and it's just amazing what's been happening in the area of carbon nanotubes. So I'm going to spend a number of slides focusing on that particular material, because there are just so many things that that can be done and people are doing with it. Nanotubes can be welded. We'll talk a little bit about that. And also talk about what's happening in the area of molecular motors. So, positional synthesis. Ho and Lee at Cornell University did this in 1999, this marvelous experiment, where they took the tip of a scanning tunneling microscope and brought it down to the surface where they had some carbon monoxide sitting on this surface of silver atoms. And using electrostatic forces, the carbon monoxide stuck to the STM tip. Then they moved it over to where they had an individual iron atom sitting on the surface. They applied a voltage and chemically bound the carbon monoxide molecule to the iron atom. So this was the key demonstration that positional synthesis under programmable control is not only possible but was done. 1999. Here you see the image of the experiment. Here's an individual CO molecule, individual iron atom. And then they bound the CO to the iron. Then they did it again. They picked up another CO and bound another one to that complex and formed FeCO2. And also, in the course of that experiment, had an elegant method of showing that they had done what they thought they did. By the way, if you're furiously trying to take notes and copy down the URLs, don't worry about that, because my understanding is that the Foresight people are going to put a PDF version of this talk up on the web so you can access it. So don't worry about that. Here's an example of mechanosynthesis. What happened here is this is done at Osaka. You've got an array of silicon atoms. They were able to use an atomic force microscope to remove one of the silicon atoms. So you've got a hole there, and they were able to put it back as well after it was stuck to the tip, able to put it back into position. So the difference here is there was no voltage applied. This is all purely mechanical. And as Jim Von Ehr pointed out, so I threw that into the presentation, the work of Joe Leiding at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, has done hydrogen abstraction. And this is, I'm going to have to get the graphics either from you or somebody. I couldn't find them. But really elegant work, because what they've done, you've got, again, an array of silicon. They were able to passivate the surface, excuse me, with hydrogen, and then pick off individual hydrogen atoms from that surface. Now you've got a dangling bond that you can use to attach some other kind of molecule. So you can build up an array of specific kinds of molecules on the surface by abstracting hydrogen and then depositing a different kind of molecule. So that's the experiment. What's been happening in theory, and there've been there's been a lot going on, especially recently. This was earlier work, the mid '90s, by Donald Brenner, who did a molecular dynamics simulation. You've got a diamond anvil here and a diamondoid surface here. You've got hydrogen atoms sticking up here, and what he showed was if you have these carbons dangling off the end, so you've got a bond that's just looking for a hydrogen atom. If you bring this whole anvil down to the surface, the hydrogen atoms just pop right from the surface onto that dangling bond. And he showed that quite elegantly. Also, the earlier work of Charles Musgrave showed that theoretically would happen as well. And I'm going to talk about some of the other work coming up here. So Rob Freitas, who's here this morning, good morning, Rob, has a provisional patent on a technique to do diamondoid mechanosynthesis, and using tips that consist of molecules that are commercially available. And what you see here are two, and Rob presented this at last year's conference, by the way. You've got two carbon atoms here, moves it down to a surface, the atoms get transferred from the tip to the surface. And this is, I want to mention that's a Zyvex patent, by the way. So Zyvex has intellectual property on that. And Damian Alice and Eric Drexler have done a very nice analysis paper, just came out this year, on diamondoid mechanosynthesis. There's Damian relaxing in his lab, and Eric, and there's Damian back there relaxing as well. Good morning. So again, in a similar fashion, you have an exposed carbon dimer at this tip, and moving it down to an appropriate surface can transfer that carbon dimer to a growing workpiece, and that's essentially what you were seeing in the animation that I showed earlier. The analysis was based on density functional theory, and there is a talk on this Thursday, is that right? Coming up in this conference, don't miss it. Also wanted to point out that the paper includes a really extensive treatment of the reliability of the process and potential failure modes. It's a very, very, very nice piece of work. And there's more coming. If you go to Rob Freitas's website, you'll see he's got a couple of books in the work, one on diamond mechanosynthesis, and coming up with Josh Hawley even later on the fundamentals of nanomechanical engineering, a textbook planned. So a lot happening in the area of theory of positional mechanosynthesis. I don't have an extensive review of the state of the art in the hardware, but I did want to point out a few things that I think are worthy of note. One is this combination STM-SEM that is available from Omicron. I don't know the price tag on it. I imagine it's pretty hefty. But what they've got, if you look down from the top here, you've got four scanning tunneling microscope heads coming in here, and the column, SEM column coming down the top. So it allows you to image what it is that you're doing. And having four heads really increases your degrees of freedom in terms of your ability to hold things and to position and move things. I don't think that was the original intent of this this company, to have a machine that can build do any kind of molecular manufacturing, but I just wanted to point out that it does give you some interesting possibilities in that regard. Also, want to point out the recent products of one of my favorite companies, Zyvex, because they're really targeting in the long term molecular assemblers, and the first company that ever announced that they were going after molecular assembly as a target, long-term target. But in along the way, they've got some nice intermediate products that look like they're going to be pretty successful. So here, once again, you've got this configuration where you've got four positioners coming in at right angles to each other. And as Jim Von Ehr mentioned the other day, that this whole unit can be inserted into into an electron microscope. So a couple of key things here. One is the tungsten wire probe, and I may have to be corrected on that. I think you said it was 45 nanometers, not 65. So a pretty small target. And the other thing is this interesting nano effector micro gripper that they've come up with. So based on MEMS technology, they're able to have these tongs, essentially. It can come in and you apply a voltage and squeeze them together. You're able to manipulate objects. So you can't manipulate individual molecules at this point. We're talking about 1 to 500 microns. But this is clearly a step in the right direction, and having opposable thumbs at small scales certainly gives you a better ability to move things around. So at this point, I'm going to switch gears a little and spend some time talking about carbon nanotubes, because I think they're a really important advance, really important kind of material. In the path towards molecular manufacturing systems. They have so many useful properties. They're, as structural members, they are stiff and strong. We can join them, we can bend them, manipulate, break them. As you saw in the poster session, we have the ability to functionalize the surface of carbon nanotubes. And they can also serve as mechanical devices, and I will show you an example of that coming up. In addition, they have extremely high thermal conductivity, higher than diamond in the direction of the axis. So one of the highest thermal conductivities known, and also a very high electrical conductivity on the order of the electrical conductivity of copper. But with 10,000 times the ability to carry current, so 10,000 times the current density of copper can be transmitted through these things. So as a result, they can be used as field emitters, and companies such as Motorola and Samsung are using them to make flat panel displays. So they're great. I mean, here's this carpet of carbon nanotubes that have been grown from this surface. A swath of them have been shoved aside, so you can see what they look like in cross section here. But here you see a whole slew of them, just all grown to uniform length. You can grow them in arrays. You nucleate the growth with a little bit of iron at each site, and the nanotubes grow out of that nucleus. This work was done by Rod Ruoff. This, as Jim Von Ehr pointed out, this was actually work done at Zyvex. We've got two atomic force microscope tips. What they've done is, it's really hard to see in this slide, but there's actually a carbon nanotube coming right along there. It's been joined to both tips. And they did a tensile test. They measured the force that it took to pull the nanotube apart, and measured the strength of the carbon nanotube, 2000. Rod Ruoff at Northwestern. Florian Banhart, University of Ulm, showed you can weld these things. You shoot an electron beam down at a point. What happens is all the crud that's on the inside of the electron microscope, it gets attracted to that point. So you're actually welding it with this kind of muck from the inside of the electron microscope. Maybe not the best material to do that with. Again, work that was done at Zyvex. You can put these things together, scaffolding. Here you see the carbon nanotube that's been wrapped around two posts. Here, carbon nanotubes that have been grown between silicon towers. It's almost like a telegraph wire from tower to tower. Grow the nanotubes, send a signal down. And I'm really happy that Dr. Zettel is going to be speaking at this conference, because I've been hoping to hear him talk. I've been a big fan of the work that's going on at Lawrence Berkeley and UC Berkeley, and here's one example. They showed that nested carbon nanotubes. There's a van der Waals force that you can measure this nested nanotubes. If you pull an inner tube, with a scanning probe tip, pull the nanotube and then release it, you see it actually goes right back into the outer nanotube and starts to oscillate. So you have what is essentially, from a molecular machine standpoint, is one, a telescoping arm, and two, in effect, a very low friction bearings. These nanotubes can rotate around each other. And he used that to great effect in this wonderful experiment where you've got a nested carbon nanotube between two electrodes, plated this gold rotor on the middle. One nanotube rotates around the other, apply an alternating current. You've got voltage here, voltage here. You make this thing spin around. So a molecular motor. I think you're going to hear about that in detail. There's also this wonderful work they've been doing with droplets of indium on a carbon nanotube and able to make these things grow and shrink, and I'm hoping we'll also hear more about that today. But again, this nanomechanical oscillator of growing indium droplets. Okay, so those are our active molecular structures, machines. And I'm going to back up a little bit and talk about the work that's been going on in terms of static molecular structures and efforts to build molecular components based on simple building blocks. And one piece of work is that of Ned Siemens. And if you were here a few days ago, you heard. Heard some more about this, but what his group has figured out, that you can have these triangular units based on DNA, and he's over several decades gotten very good at changing the structure of DNA to shapes that are interesting and apparently useful. So what you've got here is you've got these building blocks that self-assemble onto a surface, and build up an array. And so you can see that by having these things deposit on a surface, they self-organize into this honeycomb structure. So that's interesting. And then very recently, the Chris Schaffmeister's group at the University of Pittsburgh has been doing some just fantastic research in the ability to take some simple monomers and build ladder-like structures that are stiff and fairly rigid. And to arbitrarily affect the I'm sorry, there's a poster on this that you may have seen from Chris Levins, who's here this morning. You may have seen that poster, but what they're doing is essentially taking these building blocks and building up these rigid ladder-like structures into a variety of shapes. And the really cool thing about their technique is not only can they build these structures into different shapes, But they have the ability to do the reverse engineering process, so they can decide what shape it is that they want to construct, and then they have computational methods that give them the synthesis steps that they need to take to put those monomers into place to build the structure that they want. So what the applications are is to be able to shape these things into cavities that can serve as receptor sites for binding, for catalysis. Just think that there are a lot of possibilities with this technology. I'm really excited about it. There's been a lot of work done over the years on biological molecular motors, and this is just one example. The nanomachine group at Osaka, you know, ferreting out the molecular functioning of these biological motors, protein nanomachine project at Arato, and you saw if you were here this past weekend, Richard Jones had some really nice animations of ATP synthase. You feed these things chemicals and they spin around, and they can spin from 20,000 to 100,000 RPM. They're 30 or 40 nanometers in diameter. Well, you know, what good is that? What good are biological molecular machines? The good is that it is possible to take these things out of their biological environment, and you could put them on a test tube. But as long as you have the rotor intact, and you feed it the ATP, it'll spin. It doesn't have to be sitting in a cell. So what Carlo Montemagno has been to say, okay, well, why don't we take these things, attach them to inorganic substrates, and use them? And so here he's got a scheme of having antibody receptors on this spinning ATP synthase, and grabbing them out of solution and concentrating them and moving the antibodies out in a directed fashion. So that's some of the best work that's being done on hybrid machines. Do I have a timer? Do I know how? I have 10 minutes left. Is that right? I should have till 9:20. 20 minutes left. Thank you. Be still my heart. Okay. I'm going to just summarize what's happening here in the area of molecular electronic devices. There are a lot of groups that are working on building molecular memory devices and molecular computing devices, and virtually all of them, interestingly enough, are using carbon nanotubes in one form or another. It's just turned out to be such an appropriate material because of its electrical properties. It can be made semiconducting. It can be made into a transistor. And if you saw the animation I had going from Nantero, you can go to their website and see the animation as well. They have a really nice scheme for using carbon nanotubes in a molecular memory device. So here's just an illustration from some early work done by Hewlett-Packard. It's order of magnitude shots going down from macro scale down to the circuit level. And here you can see you've got the leads coming in, and these are the carbon nanotubes crisscrossing each other, and each one is a memory. This is a 64-bit a memory, and I understand they scaled this up to 64 kilobit memory in a DARPA program. I don't have the results to show you from that. But the point being that there is a lot of activity going on in the area of molecular electronic devices, and molecular computers are coming in independent of the development of molecular manufacturing systems. So that's happening now. getting close to commercialization, I think. Well, what about the design of molecular manufacturing systems? Been a lot of work done in the past. You I'm sure, are very familiar with the work of Eric Drexler and Ralph Merkel in that regard. And from those designs, there have then been some validation that those designs are not just fantasy or cartoon drawings of what we'd like to see, but in fact, they were designed using molecular mechanics, tools, and software. And subsequently, Bill Goddard was one of the real pioneers in being able to model these things. You know, he modeled, actually computationally abused, because he ran this thing 1,000 times its design. Oh, there you are. But we know the reason why you did that, you know, just so you could get some results in a reasonable amount of time. But the amazing thing, and I'm glad you did that, because this thing held up, being run 1,000 times faster than it was designed to run. It didn't fall apart, and to me that's just astonishing. Recently, Josh Hall has been doing some work at NanoRex, and in collaboration with Eric Drexler, here is a design using the new software that NanoRex has been developing of one of those cavities, one of those receptor sites that I showed earlier with the enzyme binding. So here would be the receptor site for one of those sorting rotors. Oh, Josh is the one on the right. Sorry, Josh, I couldn't resist. Okay, so for me, one of the bright moments of this conference is seeing the amazing progress that NanoRex has made in terms of computational tools that will help us design and simulate molecular machines. And it's stunning because they started a year and a half. And so from scratch, they just assembled apparently an array of amazing talent and have come up with a product that allows you to design and simulate molecular machine structures. And admittedly, it looks like they're very good at the diamondoid type of molecular machine structure. And in deference to Richard Jones, not the soft machine kind, but this is just. It's hard to overemphasize how important this achievement is, because it's not only a tool that apparently is very good at what it's intended to do, but it's going to be made freely available. So a lot of people are going to be able to have this tool and start designing molecular machines. And this is exactly what the field needed. It was hard to know quite where to insert this slide, but I really had to put it in, because one of the criticisms that I've been hearing over many years of molecular manufacturing systems, you know, this is all fantasy. We don't know how to do self-replicating machines. Rob Freitas and Ralph Merkel have really nailed this one with this book, Kinematic Self-Replicating Machines, and you can find this online. It is an exhaustive review of the field, and it turns out there actually has been a lot of work, both historically and currently, in the area of self-replicating systems. They've come up with this 137-dimensional map of the kinematic replicator design space. Here's just some of the major categories from that map. And one of the things that this book also does is, you know, it helps us understand the differences between, you know, all replicators are not the same. You know, this kind of fictional Michael Crichton non-productive replicator to more useful and productive replicators that would not really be a problem in terms of getting out of control in the environment, the things that we sometimes hear people are worried about. And so the text really does define the differences between those kinds of replicators. I recommend it. So I want to finish up the talk with a few thoughts about how we're getting to from where we are now to that full-blown vision of molecular manufacturing. And there's more than one way to do it. Richard Feynman in his talk outlined a pathway of larger machines, making smaller, all the way down until you're able to manipulate and construct with individual atoms. That's one pathway. There's kind of a top-down technique using lithographic methods. You know, we're getting better and better at making small structures lithographically. You've seen some examples in this talk of self-organizing materials. This is actually a huge area of supermolecular chemistry. There's a lot of people looking at that and self-assembly as well. Ned Seaman, as you've seen, is doing engineering of DNA there, and I've completely neglected in this talk the whole area of protein engineering, the design of proteins that are easy to design, not the complex proteins that fold and are very convoluted and might be hard to make molecular structures from those, but proteins that are designed to be easy to use as structural components. I've showed you one example of a hybrid biological. You know, why not take the machines that are already out there and use them if we can? A hybrid with inorganic structures. And then the STM technology that's been allowing us to, although crudely, manipulate individual atoms and molecules. And finally, what I think is the rise of molecular robotic systems. You've seen some very early steps towards that regard. We're starting to be able to make structures that move, that we can control from the macroscopic domain down to the molecular domain, and we can make those things move in ways that we want. And I wanted to mention while I was at it, the Nanterro molecular memory cell. In that design, when you apply voltage, you're actually moving the carbon nanotube down towards the surface. So even though this is not the intent, what they're doing at Nanterro, I think an interesting point here is that from the macro scale, you can apply voltages and you can start moving carbon nanotubes in a very controlled fashion. And once you can do that, you know, think about, okay, we can weld things onto nanotubes, so now we can have structures that move and we can attach other structures to them. And to me, this is the beginning of molecular robotic systems. I don't think it will be very long until we start seeing a molecular robot in a lab somewhere. Well, this is going to take time. I don't want to trivialize any of this. There's a lot of hard work to be done. And, what's going to affect the amount of time that it takes until we see molecular manufacturing? The quality and focus of the effort. There has not, there's no molecular manufacturing initiative in the federal government, for example, at this point. I think if there were efforts that were like that, that had large amounts of funding, that we would see a lot faster progress. But only of course, if the quality is there. You have to be focused in the right direction and doing the right things. I think that to a large extent, the funding on the federal level, you know, has been focused at the science, and the technology has kind of been just an afterthought. You know, I've even heard a government representative say, well, we just threw that in because it was politically necessary to say that we're doing technology as well as science. But most of the focus has just been on the science. But this is a manufacturing technology. You know, we need to get the technologists, the engineering community interested and involved and thinking about building machines. Again, the magnitude of the funding is going to directly affect the rate of progress. And also, there's a perception, and there's a turn of the tide that I've begun to see this year in terms of is this stuff fantasy or can we really do this? I think people are starting to realize, especially after you have groups like Alex Zettel's group actually building working molecular machines, that yes, maybe this really can be done. So, but there's that perception. If people don't think that it can be done in the near future, they're not even going to think about it or attempt to try it. If people start to realize that, it's possible with today's technology to start building useful molecular machines, you're going to see a lot more interest and focus in that regard. And also the talent pool, and you know, this is a challenge towards our educational system. Getting students with the right background to go out into a commercial environment and to start doing the things that need to be done to create molecular manufacturing systems. And I was really pleased to be speaking with Steve Vetter, who is apparently putting together an undergraduate curriculum for doing just that. So that's a very positive step. Technological challenges, we need even better instrumentation. The tools for manipulation are not really good right now. They're getting better. You saw the work of Zyvex, I think is a good effort. We need molecular tips. As Rob Freitas' Zyvex patent is showing, this is within our grasp, and we just need to be able to have the right tips to start picking up molecules and depositing atoms into a workpiece. I think we're close. We've seen a lot of progress here in the area of molecular building blocks. I think a richer library will help. And I had this here. I put this slide together in a talk I gave to the National Academies back in February, because this was a real problem until now. And with the advent of NanoRex's Nano Engineer 1, I think we've gone a huge amount of the way in having the computational tools that we need for analysis and design of molecular manufacturing systems. And finally, as you probably gathered from that animation, the John Birch animation, it's not going to be trivial. You know, we're talking about not thousands, not millions, not billions or trillions, but, you know, 10 to the 15, 10 to the 18 components in a molecular manufacturing system, if we're going to make parts that are of macroscopic use, and getting all those things to work together, while not necessarily complex, and Ralph Merkel has done some work explaining to us that the complexity is not intractable, but certainly it's massively parallel. And so there are a lot of design and systems integration issues that need to be thought about. So in summary, And hopefully I'm not too far off time here. There is, in fact, a clear vision of what molecular manufacturing could be. It's not the only possible vision, but it helps to have one, certainly. The theoretical basis for molecular manufacturing has really been pretty well established through engineering analysis from the work of Eric Drexler, and now the continuing work of people like Damian Allis, and that wonderful paper, and Rob Freitas and Ralph Merkel and others. Positional molecular assembly is not fantasy. It's been done. It's possible. Molecular machines based on carbon nanotubes have been made. So we have working molecular machines. We've seen that there are self-assembling molecules that can serve as useful building blocks, and I'm really excited about the new advances here. And we can also exploit the capabilities of existing biological molecular machines, molecular motors in particular. That was a flagellar motor that I was showing. We have continuous improvement in the capabilities of new instrumentation, and but there's certainly more improvements that need to be made in the area of manipulation of individual molecules. That would certainly be helful. And imaging is pretty good. And once again, new software, improved design tools to design molecular manufacturing systems. So I leave you with a very positive view of the progress in molecular manufacturing. I think we have made, we've gone a long way in just the past 2 or 3 years towards seeing things that we're finally, seeing the realization of molecular machines that are working, advances in theory, and particularly this wonderful new advance in computational tools. So with that, thank you very much. And Mr. Chairman, I don't know if we have time for any questions, but fire away.
Short questions and short answers.
Okay.
I didn't notice who was first. Back in the corner?
Are there, I think there are microphones that will be handed to you.
Yes. One thing that a lot of the, certainly not all, but a lot of the work in molecular manufacturing is predicated on sort of being able to maneuver and play with carbon nanotubes at the nano level. Can you say something about the recent change in costs of carbon nanotubes? Just a few words. I don't know what the...
they are getting cheaper. There are a number of companies that realize the potential of carbon nanotubes and have... gone after that whole scale-up issue, and they realize they have to produce carbon nanotubes not in microgram quantities, but tonnages of carbon nanotubes.
That's good. Next, one more.
Thank you. That was a beautiful overview of the state of the art. One of your last slides where you gave a list of the remaining technical challenges or the technical challenges as they stand today, there's one thing on there that I've been thinking about that I didn't see on there, and I wonder if you could comment on whether you see this as a challenge and its importance. The representation of a macroscopic shape in terms of its molecular subcomponents. So when I say representation, one of the important elements of modern digital manufacturing is the existence of CAD tools that represent the shape of the final product, but it's done in terms of a continuum mathematics, assuming there is no smallest element, whereas DNA represents the ultimate three-dimensional shape of an organism in terms of some system of representation that we don't yet understand. So I wonder if you see this as a future challenge, to have a representation of a three-dimensional macroscopic shape in terms of its molecular components.
Well, animals made of cells and plants made of cells are not just representations of DNA. I mean, they have a cellular component to them. So, in terms of this vision of molecular manufacturing, there's really not an analogy, because we're not talking about the recipe for the structure of the ultimate macroscopic object being embedded within the object itself. What we're talking about is just putting the atoms where you want them and having this atomically precise macroscopic object. And there's no reason to contain that, that information in the object itself. So,
I wasn't talking about where the representation is contained, but just
the point that in the slide he said where I overdid the gear thing. The point of that paper was that there are discrete choices in atoms. Atoms have certain discrete sizes. If you want one that's 1.163, it may not exist. And so the point is, you've got to design with, in fact, keeping in mind where the atoms have to be ultimately in making the devices. And so there is an issue there, people have been able to self-assemble biological systems, so they may be solved. I want to thank David for really broad-based review of the whole field and mentioning all the work since you in the field, even ours. Thank you, David.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So I'm charged with keeping this thing on schedule, and the way they did it, they put my talk last.